Everyone has a plan until they get hit. That is probably Mike Tyson's most famous quote in a long catalog of memorable maxims. Over the years, people have, I'm sure you've heard it, but people have embellished that line to make it more hard-hitting. Usually you hear it repeated or quoted as, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. But Iron Mike confirmed the simpler version when asked about it by a journalist in 2012. The quote really has taken on a life of its own. I'm sure everybody has heard that before. I've heard it quoted in movies in slightly different forms. Tyson said it first for the first time. He said it a variety of times over his career, but for the first time, he said it in 1987 before fighting Tyrell Biggs for the Undisputed Heavyweight Championship. That fight was billed as the Clash for the Crown. When they entered the ring, Biggs was undefeated. He was also a full 12 pounds heavier than Mike Tyson. People had been asking Mike what he was going to do in the fight. Biggs is gonna move, he's gonna dance, he's gonna do this, he's gonna do that, he's gonna give you a lot of lateral movement. That's what Mike said people were telling him before the fight. But Iron Mike wasn't worried. Here's what he said, most talkers, they can't handle it. And he was right. Biggs threw a lot of sharp jabs, but after 7 rounds, Tyson hit Biggs with a left hook that sent Biggs to the canvas and almost out of the ring altogether. He was on his feet before the 10 count, but it was clear who was going to win this fight, and the ref called it right then and there. On the Tuesday and Wednesday before his crucifixion, Jesus contended in a multi-round fight with some heavy hitters who wanted the crown for themselves. From Mark 11:27 to Mark 12:37, there are 5 conflict episodes all stacked one right after another. And Jesus' opponents weren't just out for a belt and weren't just out for bragging rights. They wanted to knock Jesus out. They wanted him discredited. They wanted him destroyed. They wanted him dead. And they had quite a strategy to take him down, or at least they thought they did. We'll find every time they tried a lateral move, every time they jabbed, every time they tried to land a blow on Jesus, every time he delivers a spiritual left hook, sending them out of the ring to regroup, reconspire, and try again, round after round after round. Look at verse 27. They, speaking of Jesus and his disciples, they came again to Jerusalem. As he was walking in the temple, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders came and asked him, by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority to do these things? Okay, so the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, these are the 3 groups that make up the Sanhedrin. This probably wouldn't have been the whole 72 of the Sanhedrin, but a delegation that represented the whole. They came to challenge the Lord and try to put him in his place. They had trained for this, they had prepared for this, and so they come very officially to debate with the Lord and to try to knock him out of influence. His place in their minds was to be under their authority. Who gave you authority to do these things? Because it certainly wasn't us. That's what they're saying. And authority is what they cared about. Do you notice? When they came to talk to Jesus, when they came to ask about the dramatic things he had been doing, when they came to discuss why he had stopped all that commerce in the temple that we looked at last time, why he flipped the tables, did you notice they don't bother arguing about right and wrong? They don't bother talking about lawful or unlawful. They don't actually care about any of that. They don't care about whether what was happening actually fit in with the commands of God or even the law of Moses. No, they didn't care about the prophecies of Isaiah or Jeremiah or the Father's intention to bring Gentiles into the family of God. They didn't care about any of that. They cared about authority. They're not concerned with theological integrity, but with power and control. Power can be a terribly addictive narcotic. It can cloud the mind and warp a person's attitude and interactions with others. These guys, most of the members of the Sanhedrin, not all of them, there are a couple of members of the Sanhedrin who were really solid stand-up fellows, Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea, but the vast majority of them, they were obsessed with power, and they were convinced that they were the most important, most consequential people in the nation. The irony, of course, you know, this is all about they're jealous. They're jealous that Jesus was saying the things that he was saying, that the crowds were going after him. That was the whole problem, really. All the crowds are going after Jesus. All of the crowds are impressed with Jesus. We don't like what he's saying. We don't like that he's not under us. We don't like that he's taking attention from us. All of these other things. And they were angry about his message as well. But it was all about how important they were. And the great irony is that their nation was occupied and oppressed by a much more powerful nation. These guys are swaggering around in the temple, acting like they have power, acting like they have status. They only have status because the emperor of Rome had decided not to annihilate all of them. You know, it was a pretend status. It was a pretend importance, you know, not even just in the eyes of God, but even in the eyes of men. They were allowed to exist. Of course, they weren't allowed to do all of the things that they were supposed to do. They weren't allowed to rule themselves. They weren't allowed to carry out capital punishment. That's why they needed to enlist the Romans. And so they think they have this power, but they're really impotent in the ability to actually wield what it is they think that they have. But even though that was the reality, these religious leaders were constantly on a power trip. Christians, sometimes we're going to get some measure of what we would call power, maybe at work, maybe in our community, whatever it is. Some level of influence or authority of oversight. We need to remember all that Jesus has been teaching his disciples in Mark about what kingdom power is, about what kingdom greatness looks like. We do well to remember that he has called all of his people to humility, to deference, and to not thinking more highly of ourselves than we ought. The Apostle Paul puts it really bluntly in Galatians 6, you are not that important. I am not that important. No matter who we are, the Apostle Paul looks at us and looks at himself, and he says, we are not that important. And so if you get into a position of oversight or management or power or authority, no matter how small or great it is, just remember that what God considers greatness, how God wields, you know, how Jesus showed us what it meant to be spiritual and powerful. He was the servant of all. He washed feet. He did. He came to serve, not to be served. Now, if Jesus was merely a man, this would have been an incredibly intimidating situation. The Sanhedrin, they are Israel's executive, legislative, and judicial governments rolled into one. They didn't have quite the separation of powers that we do in America. It's all one body. These are the heavy hitters. These are the people of utmost influence and power and sway in the whole nation. And they are determined to focus all of their attention and ability on silencing this teacher from Nazareth. And so if Jesus had just been a man, this would have been a fight that he probably wouldn't have come out of unscathed. But Jesus was not just a man. He's the God-man. And so not only is he not intimidated, in fact, he saw them coming. He met them head on. The story starts with he goes to Jerusalem. He knows what's happening that day. He knows what's going to go on in the temple. He goes on purpose. This situation is a direct fulfillment of what Jesus had predicted more than once, but specifically back in Mark 8, verse 31. In Mark 8, 31, he's talking to his disciples and he says, hey, we're going to head to Jerusalem and here's what's going to happen. He says, the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes will reject me. And then after that, I'm going to be mistreated. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to then rise again from the dead. And so it's just amazing. Jesus knows exactly what's going on. He did not shrink from the cross. He didn't shrink from the suffering. He didn't shrink from the fight. He comes again into Jerusalem. Again into the ring to fight so that we could be redeemed. And in this section, we watch him do it round after round after round, going the distance until the job was done. Now, here's what's interesting. They want to know what authority Jesus had to do and say the things he was doing and saying. What authority do you think you have? In other words, what are your credentials? Who has given you the right, the status, to dare to disagree with us? That's what they're asking. And it's true, Jesus had no formal training. See, that was something else they did not like about Jesus. He didn't go through their rabbinical schools. He was an outsider. He was from the sticks as far as they were concerned. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? And so yeah, Jesus had no formal training. He had no pedigree, humanly speaking. But here's the stark truth. Everyone, and I mean everyone, knew that Jesus had more authority than the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians and the elders and the chief priests and the high priest himself. Everyone knew it. Do you remember what Mark said all the way back in chapter 1? The people were astonished because Jesus was teaching them as one who had authority and not like the scribes. And so it's this interesting irony. These guys are swaggering around in their robes and in their pomp and in their, you know, self-importance, telling everyone how much better they were, how much smarter they were, how much greater they were. And then as soon as those guys were gone, everybody was like, these guys, when they talk, we can tell they have no authority. We can tell that they're not speaking for God. Oh, Jesus, I heard five words from Jesus. This guy, he has authority. He teaches as one who really knows the Father, as who really knows the Word, not like the scribes. And so it's pretty interesting. Even as they debate here in this scene, it's clear Jesus holds all the true power. Look in verse 29. Jesus said to them, I'll ask you one question, then answer me, and I'll tell you what by what authority I do these things. So we're going to see that they immediately, they do what Jesus says. Now, you know, scholars will say, well, this was a debate tactic that people were used to at the time, but they're a whole group, and they think he's a criminal, and they think he's an outsider. I mean, they could have said, no. Well, we demand, we're here as the Supreme Court of Israel, and we want an answer. But instead, Jesus demonstrates total authority right here. He is in charge. He's in charge of this situation. See, they came and said, we want to point out that we never gave you any authority, but Jesus doesn't need their authority. And so their complaint and their accusation makes no impact. It doesn't push him off balance. It doesn't push him onto the ropes. The punch doesn't land. I'm guessing that when they said, you know, all this stuff about who gave you authority, I'm guessing that some people listening in the crowd rolled their eyes. Are you kidding? These guys again? You know, it was a weird thing because, you know, the Pharisees, as an example, people believed that the Pharisees had a very high level of moral superiority because they did all of these things supposedly to follow the law and, you know, they were tithing their mint and cumin, that sort of thing. But it's clear that a lot of the people, especially in this week, they were like, yeah, these guys are a bunch of phonies. They're ripping us off. And they have no authority. And they come in here and they put burdens on us. They don't help us carry any of these burdens. And meanwhile, here's Jesus giving them a real drink of the truth for the first time in their lives. And so I'm guessing the crowd was not really on the side of the Sanhedrin guys. Now, a question I had is, okay, in this scene, right, Jesus is here to be the Messiah, right? In this scene, and they say, how dare you? Who are you? Why? Who gives you authority? Why do you think you can do and say the things you're doing and saying? Why not just say, well, because I'm the Messiah, I'm the Son of God. You know, why not just have heaven open and angels descend and silence these craven scoundrels once and for all? Why not just rock their world? For real, knock them out of the temple. It reminds me of that scene in The Lord of the Rings where, you know, Bilbo is arguing with Gandalf about the ring and all of that. And there's that moment where the conflict is getting a little bit too tense. And so Gandalf, like, increases. It happens in the book too. He increases in size and majesty and scariness and it stops everything. Well, why doesn't Jesus just do that? Well, it's because Jesus always wants faith. He wants us to choose to believe him based on revelation, based off of his word, not based off of sign or manifestation that we demand for him to prove it. And Jesus knew the hearts of these fellows. They didn't actually want to know the answer. They didn't want to know. That's not why they asked. What they wanted was him gone. They wanted him removed. They had seen the signs. They had heard the teachings. They watched Lazarus come out of the tomb. It was all undeniable, and yet they denied it. And yet they said, we refuse to acknowledge, we refuse to accept the authority that has been clearly revealed. And when hearts are hard like that, When hearts are closed to revelation, to the truth, God does not smash his way in. He says, fine, stay in your ignorance, stay in your rebellion. I'm not going to force you to accept the truth. If this is what you want, you can have it. There are many times in the Gospels where someone would come and ask Jesus something, but it's not asked in humility or faith or true searching. And in those cases, Jesus pretty much always just asks them something back. He asks something deeper to reveal the heart behind the question, not just to win an argument, but to expose the truth. You know, Jesus here isn't actually interested in winning this debate. It's not about winning this argument. He could just open his mouth and win this argument by the earth swallowing these guys up, right? So this isn't actually about winning a debate. He wants to expose truth, and he wants to give them one more opportunity to stop what they're thinking and saying and look within and consider what's going on and have one more chance to put their weapons down, to stop rebelling, to stop resisting, to stop fighting and believe. And this is why he so often taught in parables, by the way, so that those who truly wanted to know were the ones who would know. Those who truly wanted to seek God, they would follow up and then they would have the wonderful secrets of the kingdom of heaven explained to them and revealed to them. See, Jesus wants to reveal truth. He wants to tell people exactly who the Father is, what he's doing, all of these things. But he's waiting for those who will demonstrate faith. And in a scene like this, where there's no question of faith here, there's no actual honesty in their question or in this situation, well, then he is going to keep the truth closed to them. Verse 30, here's Jesus' question. Was John's baptism from heaven or of human origin? Answer me. Okay, when Jesus says John's baptism, he doesn't just mean the water part. He's referring to the totality of John's ministry. But then why bring up John after all of this time? Is this just a deflection or what's going on? Is this just something because he knows the people like John? I'll be honest. When I think about John the Baptist, I mean, he seems like great, John the Baptist, but sometimes I'm like, hey, did we need John the Baptist? He feels a little bit superfluous sometimes. Did he really do that much? Was he really that necessary since Jesus was going to show up really shortly after and then start doing his ministry and Jesus and his disciples were baptizing people, right? Well, the answer is yes. John was absolutely essential. John did an incredible work from the Father. He was the forerunner of the Messiah. He himself fulfilled prophecy that Israel had been waiting for hundreds and hundreds of years. He was an essential part of God revealing who the Christ was. And Jesus ties his own ministry to John's ministry here. He wasn't just trying to distract them with a different question. He's saying, depending on what you answer about John's ministry, the answer is the same for my ministry. John wasn't just doing his thing and then Jesus came and did his thing. John was sent from God as the beginning of the work that would be accomplished through Jesus, the forerunner. He's the forerunner of the Messiah. It's part of one redemptive work where the Lord said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send my son to be the Redeemer, and part of that is to first send this guy to prepare the way and to identify the Messiah when he arrives. And so if John was sent by God, then Jesus must also be sent by God. Because John said that the one who was coming, the one he was preparing people for, was from heaven, and that person would baptize people with the Holy Spirit, and John identified Jesus as that person. He said, that's the eternal Son of God. So depending on what you think about John the Baptist, you must think something about Jesus. And if John was a true prophet, then Jesus is the Messiah, the one they'd all been waiting for. And if John was just making things up, if he was just a liar, then they, as the leaders of Israel, had the duty and responsibility of stopping him from preaching lies and prophesying falsely. That's their job, to stop false teachers and liars from polluting the nation of Israel. At very least, they should have gone out and warned the people if John was a false teacher. They were out there. When you see in the early chapters of the Gospels, John doing his ministry, these leaders are out there. They're watching him. They're listening to him. They interact with him. They're out there. They listen to him preach. And they saw how many people were convinced by his message. So if he was a prophet, they need to understand that he was sent by God. And if he was a false prophet, then what in the world were they doing? Absolutely derelict in their leadership and their duty and what they should have been doing. You know, Mike Tyson once discussed his punching strategy. He said, quote, "I'm not trying to punch him in the nose. I'm trying to punch the soft tissue behind his nose." Okay. Yikes. When Jesus asked this question, he hits hard and deep. Again, it's not just to deflect. It wasn't just to push his opponents into a corner so that he could get away. He was punching into a much deeper spiritual truth. First, he's saying if John was a prophet, John said, "I'm the eternal Son of God and I'm the Messiah." So you must agree with that, right? But there's even a deeper layer here, something that hits even harder to guys like the chief priests. Because what was John preaching out in the wilderness? Do you remember? He was out in the wilderness preaching that a person could repent and be saved without offering any sacrifices in the temple. It was a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. That's what the Gospels say. That's what John said. And so if John's ministry was from heaven, if John was, you know, given authority by God the Father, not only does that mean Jesus is the Messiah, but it means the temple is obsolete. Because John says, come out here, repent, and you're going to have forgiveness of sins. The temple's obsolete. The sacrificial system is obsolete. At least it will be after the Lamb of God lays down his life and is the final sacrifice. And of course, that's exactly what happened. That's why you didn't bring a lamb or a turtle dove or a bullock to church here tonight. But with one question, one very simple question, the Lord lays out just how powerful he was. So the Sanhedrin is absolutely on the ropes. Let's see their response. Verse 31, they discussed it among themselves. If we say from heaven, he will say, then why didn't you believe him? If we say of human origin, they were afraid of the crowd because everyone thought that John was truly a prophet. And man, when Mark says that, he really means it. John's spiritual authority was never in question among the people of Israel. Did you know that even Josephus, the Jewish historian, calls John a good and righteous man who commanded Jews in the righteousness of God and the piety towards God? And that John was so beloved and respected that when Herod's army was eventually destroyed, it was largely believed around the nation that God had destroyed Herod's army because he was angry with Herod killing John the Baptist. That's not what the Christians thought. Josephus is no Christian. That's what the Jews thought. Everyone respected John that much. He was believed to be a true prophet. That's how revered he was by everyone except Herod and his wife. Now, this is a comedic moment in the temple. This official delegation full of pomp and venom, they confront Jesus. They think they've got him. They think they're ambushing him and they're going to knock him out. And Jesus asks them one question and they have to say, time out. And they go huddle up. They say, give us a second. This is silly. Can you imagine? I mean, like the Supreme Court coming and like if they had even more power than they did and they say, hey, we have something we have to say to you and we want answers. And then the person asks one question, they say, no, okay, hold on. And they go over there and they strategize about how in the world they're gonna answer this very basic question. The answer's obvious. You have to say, well, John was a false prophet. Ah, but then why didn't you call him a false prophet? And why didn't you do your duty under the law of Moses of dealing with him as a false prophet? And so it's an amazing scene. So they go huddle up, they discuss what they're gonna say, and you see, again, it's never about theology, it's never about right and wrong, it's never about truth and lies, it's always the politics of it. And we see they're downright scared to answer. They stop mid-sentence in verse 32, but if we say of human origin, and the sentence just dies right there. Mike Tyson's famous quote, everyone has a plan until they get hit. That's not the end of the quote. No one ever hears the rest of the quote. I think we should tack the rest of it on. Here's what he said, the full quote. Everyone has a plan until they get hit. Then, like a rat, they stop in fear and freeze. It's exactly what happens right here. The chief priests, the scribes, the elders, all their power, all of their swagger, all of their sway, all of their position. One question. They're exposed as phonies and hypocrites and political animals. They didn't care if John was a prophet. They didn't care then. They don't care now. They only cared about holding on to their own position, their own influence over the crowds. And we see they don't respect the crowds. They don't actually care about the people of Israel. They just want power over them. Verse 33. So they answered Jesus, "We don't know." And Jesus said to them, "All right, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Jesus doesn't play games. "We don't know." What a joke. It is your job to know. That's your job. You're the Sanhedrin. "We don't know." Like, understand, that's literally their job. And what they have said, they've dedicated their lives to. And what they've told everyone in the whole nation that they are the absolute authority and experts on, that the buck stops with them, that they say it and that's it. And they say, "We don't know." They are the ones who were tasked with maintaining the spiritual and doctrinal integrity for the nation. That's the job, to know whether John was a true prophet from God or a false prophet who needed to be stoned. That's your job. If you don't know, then what are you here for? Then why should I go to you for anything else? But like I said, Jesus has no interest in playing games with them. They don't want truth. They want status. If they had been really seeking God, the Lord would have answered them. He would have conversed with them. We know that's true because Nicodemus is a member of the Sanhedrin, the teacher of Israel. He comes to Jesus in John 3, and he has genuine questions. He has genuine desire to seek out the truth. And what does Jesus do? He has an extended dialogue with him. He reveals truth to him, things that were hard for Nicodemus to understand, but eventually he did. What a great arc the story of Nicodemus has. As after the crucifixion, he says, "Let me embalm the body of Jesus myself." And he goes and does that, despite the fact that all of this, his colleagues and buddies in the Sanhedrin were wanting to kill all the people who were following after Jesus. But for those who don't actually care, for those who refuse faith, for those who reject revelation, well, the truth is withheld. They could have had an answer to their original question. What was their question? "Where do you get your authority, Jesus?" They could have had an answer to that if they really wanted one. One commentator writes, "For those who will look below the surface, there is a clear enough answer. Blind Bartimaeus knew exactly who Jesus was and where he got his authority. And he hadn't seen any of the things that these guys had seen. He hadn't heard any of the things that these men had listened to Jesus preach for 3.5 years. So they could have had an answer if they actually wanted it. And the truth is, in the very next passage, Jesus is going to teach a parable to the other people there in the temple, which reveals exactly who he is and where he gets his authority for those who are interested in actually learning. Mike Tyson beat Terrell Biggs in a TKO technical knockout. His victory was clear. But it wasn't a Hollywood knockout. You know, it wasn't like Rocky where, you know, knocks him down and then that's it. They count to 10 and it's over. Biggs ended the fight on his feet. Now, he was powerless, but he was still standing. The chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, they were powerless, still on their feet. But they limped away from this round, only to come back for more. And then another, and then another, as we'll see as this chapter and chapter 12 unfold. Each time, Jesus showed just how much authority he had. And we as readers see, and Jesus was pulling his punches. Lord could have made these things go very differently had he not been a God of patience and compassion, of grace and mercy. And this isn't just about Jesus being a great debater. It's that his absolute power and authority and rightness could not be denied. It doesn't matter who asked him the question. These guys, Sadducees, Pharisees, doesn't matter. Jesus is always right. Jesus is always correct. He's never off balance. He cannot be denied. And yet, many people continually deny him. May we live in acceptance, not denial, of Christ's authority, Christ's absolute authority over heaven, over earth, over our lives, over our tomorrow, as we follow him, as we acknowledge what has been revealed to be true about the King of Kings, the one great authority in all the universe, Jesus Christ. God the Father has given all authority to him, and that includes authority over your future, your activities, my activities, your families, my family. And so let's not deny that, but honor him, obey him, and follow after him.